Good morning, everyone. I'm going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Thanks for being here a little bit earlier. The start time probably will be closer at 8 o'clock instead of 8:30, since we're into the last week and a half of getting Senate bills through this chamber, and out of committee, I should say. We're going to start with a public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 225, so I'll call in a public hearing on Senate Bill 225.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 225 has a -2 gun stuff amendment, and the amendment requires a court to suspend a driver's license of a minor if they have been cited for attempting to purchase or possess alcohol and they fail to appear in court. And it changes the relevant date for the suspension of a license for convicted juveniles from the date of conviction to the date of offense. And this one's ready to go and has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact on the -2 amendment. Thank you.
Okay. And the individuals that are signed up, Ronnell Shankle and Dina Ryerson?
Nothing. Good morning, Chair Prozowski and members of the committee. I apologize. Dina is on I-5 on her way here, but not yet present.
Okay.
For the record, I'm Ronnell Shankle with the Attorney General's Office, and Ms. Braun has actually told you the majority of what we have done. We used the relating clause on this bill that did come from the Attorney General's Underage Drinking Task Force to follow up on some dialogue that we had before this committee on way back on February 19th about the overall topic of trying to strengthen some of the laws related to underage drinking. And so basically the two provisions we put in here, one was a piece we had brought to the table about the fact that there really is no significant penalty for minors who fail to appear when they've already been charged with one of the existing statutory issues and they don't come to court. So we just wanted to clarify that the court would then have the discretion to go forward with the existing charges. And then the other piece I believe Chair Prozowski brought up related to the age at the time of offense versus the age at the time that you're for the court. So those are the only two issues in the bill. I would venture to say that they are fairly technical, but nonetheless are important to continuing our work towards this issue and reducing underage drinking, and I'll answer any questions that I can.
All right, questions. Senator Borquist.
Thank you, Chair. I thought we were already doing this.
Part of it.
So, really, I mean, this is just the failure to appear part, then. Is that correct? Because if you get in it, because I know if they get two MIPs now, they lose their license, period. And because I have that, I have several colleges in my district, and there tends to be too much drinking at colleges. And though all the complaints I have are none of them are drivers, they've lost their driver's license because they went to too many parties in McMinnville at colleges. So I thought we were already doing this.
Chair Prozowski and Senator Boquist, I think that's perhaps not clear when they actually fail to appear whether or not the courts can still issue those charges and penalties or not, so this is to clarify. Perhaps we are in some areas.
A follow-up question?
Yes.
And just failure to appear means they didn't show up, they didn't notify the court, so on and so forth like that. That's what we're talking about.
Chair Prozowski, Senator Boquist, yes, that is my understanding.
Let me just give clarification. Sometimes some courts will give a leeway on the first time if someone calls in and then reschedules them for a second time. Sometimes the courts, on the other hand, do not. And if they fail to appear on that citation, that would be grounds for that type of action.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, my question was related to, in one of the instances that we all get these, is they mailed the check, it was sent appear or send your money, right. And they sent their money in, and it should have went and appeared. And so they lost their license automatically with their check.
Okay, so I had a mandatory appearance.
Right.
Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the new amendment on page 2. It says if a person cited under this section is at least 13 years of age but less than 21 years of age, and then the court shall issue notice to suspend the person's driving privileges. What driving privileges would a 13 or 14-year-old have? And a 15-year-old would have a permit, probably, but what would a 13 or 14-year-old have?
Chair Prozowski, Senator Boquist, that's a good question. I think we simply mirrored that age language from other areas in the minor in possession statutes. They would not have driving privileges in Oregon. You are correct.
I don't think that's, I think you can.
We have it.
Here to save the day.
I didn't hear the question. I was debating whether I should come up with
one. You are on I-5 on your way.
Yeah, I was just curious about the 13 years of age. What driving privileges would a 13 or 14-year-old? I know it was people can get a permit when they're 15, but what driving privilege says a court shall suspend the person's driving privileges. But this applies to 13, if they're at least 13. So what driving privileges?
Dina, I need you to put your name on the record.
13 or 14 or
1. Thank you, Chair. Dina Ryerson, Department of Justice. As far as the, you're asking what privileges does a 13-year-old have?
What driving privileges?
What driving privileges? You know, I'm not familiar with, as far as the privileges for a 13-year-old. I didn't think there were
I didn't know
privileges.
Kevin and I could play the,
I'm having a good day.
He's trying.
I thought I had put that on my
I thought we were actually. Tuning up for the orchestra. I'll be on some 8 o'clock hour.
I thought the soonest they could get a driving privilege was you know, as you had suggested, when they were able to get the learner's permit. And I think that's exactly. I think the reason why they picked that was because this is the same language throughout the statute, where they've attached 13-year-old. So I think they were just trying to keep the statute consistent with other portions of the traffic code that refer to 13.
There are hardship, there are farm exceptions and stuff that do go to 13 years of age. And so my assumption was even on the farm side, though, they can drive on a highway at that age, that privilege would be revoked if they had an MIP, so on and so forth. So I think there are
exceptions.
I'm not positive it's 13, but I think it is 13.
There are hardships that do come in play. I don't know what the things are. So.
And maybe I can ask the council. I guess it would be interpreted that suspended person's driving privileges, if any.
Yes, I believe that's how they would interpret that.
We'd be happy to follow up on that if that's a piece you'd like us to do later in second chamber if it's unclear. We're more than happy to do that.
Yeah, maybe in the second chamber. So let me ask. Let me ask you. The one thing, Ronell, that you talked about is the court would have the discretion. Here it sounds like it's mandatory. On line 18, it says the court shall issue the notice. And so it doesn't seem like it would be discretionary with the court. I just want to put that on the record. Is that your understanding?
I think that was the intent of the underage drinking task force, was so that it wasn't in the discretion, so that when a minor defaults, well, not even a minor necessarily, they could be 18, 19, 20, 21, when they default and they don't show up for court when they're given the citation, that it indicates that the court shall.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Any other comments? All right. Let me ask, is there anyone else who wanted to give testimony? Angela was scheduled to give testimony, but I understand she may not need to. Andre, excuse me. It is early in the morning. All right, I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 225, opening up the work session on 225.
Chair, move the dash 2 and SB 225.
Senator Boquist moves the dash 2s into Senate Bill 225. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So order.
Chair, move SB 225 as amended by the dash 2 amendment to the floor with 2 passes.
Senator Boquist moves Senate Bill 225 as amended by the dash 2 amendments to the floor with a 2 pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So order. And who would like to be the carrier on this one? Senator Wissett will be our carrier. Thank you. We'll close the work session on 225. We're going to go ahead and do the work sessions that are scheduled down below. Just to put on the record at this point, Senate Bill 570, we're still waiting for the paperwork on it, so it cannot move today. So I'm going to go ahead and carry that one over till tomorrow. So Senate Bill 570 is carried over to Wednesday, April 15th. And we'll go ahead and open up the work session on Senate Bill 227.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 227 was from the Attorney General's Underage Drinking Task Force, and we had a hearing on this on February 19th, and it has a dash one amendment, and that amendment increases the fines and removes the requirement of the bill to suspend a license and adds community service as an option to reduce the fines. I think as part of the discussion on that bill, the committee had a problem with the possible nexus between the offense of furnishing alcohol to a minor and suspending the license. So in response, DOJ asked to just increase the fines. and it has a dash one amendment and no revenue impact and has a minimal fiscal impact on the dash one. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. I'm just looking at what the summary says and what the dash ones provide.
So the dash, so that dash one increased the fine. You don't have it? Further.
So
then the regular bill, and then it removes the requirement to suspend the driver's license, which was the controversial part of the bill when they heard it.
All right, so let's put this together on the record here. Ron, I want you to come on up. I've got a couple of questions as to the increase. All right, so the current law calls for a $350 fine for the first offense of a person furnishing alcohol to a minor. And looking at the dash ones, we're going from $350 to $750.
Chair Pozanski and members of the committee, yes, that is where we went based on the dialogue we had before and with this committee in February. We were asking for an additional license suspension, and it was suggested that perhaps we could look at doubling the fines and making them more stringent rather than going to that other measure. And then what we did to offset that leap, however, is add the provision to allow for the exchange of community service hours for a portion of the fine.
All right.
Which would be in the new subsection 6.
All right. Well, I can tell you the chair is not real comfortable right now seeing a fine go from $350 to $750 on a violation. I believe that that's going to tip the balance as to being able to, I mean, that's a significant increase. That's doubling, and I'm not sure what the bases are as compared to going up to 500, what the bill originally called for. So, questions, comments? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was trying to find something that was referred to in my notes. I know when we discussed this bill in February, there was a discussion about a religious exemption. I even have notes from when Paul Romaine testified and said if there should be an exception for religious ceremonies, and that should be added if it's not in there. So I don't see that. I don't know where it was added. There was also a concern about suspending a license if it's not a driving offense. So I don't know if that was addressed either.
Other questions? I'm going to tell you what the chair is out on this. I'm going to carry this over for a week. I'd like to have a little more discussion as to the appropriateness as to the amount that we're looking at. Not saying that we shouldn't increase the fines, but it seems to be a little bit disproportionate for that first offense. And the other thing I do know is there are numerous courts that these individuals go in front of that do not have the option of community service. And so I'd say a disparity in the state as to how these could actually be carried out in the non-circuit court or large municipal courts. The smaller ones don't have those options, and I think you're going to force disparity as to how it will be applied. Any other comments, questions?
No, just Mr. Chair, that if there's going to be some more study on this and discussion about it, I would prefer to make sure that a religious exemption is clarified.
Okay.
Chair Pozanski, I think we can perhaps answer that last question.
Okay.
And I'd be happy to talk with members further about the amounts.
Okay.
And Senator Pozanski, Dean Ryerson, Department of Justice, to answer the question, I believe 471-430 discusses the exemption for possession of alcohol as part of a religious rite or service. It says, however, this section does not prohibit the acceptance or consumption by any person of sacramental wine as part of a religious rite or service. So that's mentioned in a different statute, however, 471.430. Dealing with purchase or possession of alcohol, and that applies also then to providing alcohol.
All right.
So it would apply to this particular question. Thank you.
So what's it?
Thank you, Chair Przanski. Just a comment. In my notes, I also have an indication here of an enhanced penalty if the vehicle was used to deliver or furnish the alcohol. That might be incorporated into that first fine as well.
Okay. So what we're going to do is we'll set this over for 1 week. That will be a week from today, which would be April 21st. And then between the time, I'll sit down with the Department of Justice and anyone who has any other comments or concerns, if you'll get them to me in the next day or so. Okay. With that,
I'm
going to go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 227 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 601.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 601, you heard on March 18th. This clarifies that the Board of clarifies authority of the Board of Maritime Pilots to issue subpoenas, allows the Board of Maritime Pilots to enter ship for investigatory purposes if the ship is open to the public, and requires a search warrant for inspections that are not open to the public and interest is denied by the owner. This has a dash one amendment, and the amendment just deletes the word search from search warrant to cover the Board of Maritime Pilots, because they rarely investigate criminal matters, and they wanted to clarify this is civil or administrative warrants. It has a dash one amendment, no revenue impact, and a minimal fiscal impact. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And Chair will take a motion on the dash ones.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Senator Volquist moves the dash ones into Senate Bill 601. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Chair, move SB 601 with the dash one to the floor with due pass, and I'd be happy to carry it.
Senator Volquist moves Senate Bill 601 as amended by the dash ones to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objection? So ordered, and Senator Volquist will be our carrier on this one. I'll go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 601, and now we're going to go into our public hearings, and which one do we start with? I believe one of the individuals that's scheduled to testify on 9:55 may not be here yet, so let's go ahead and open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 126.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 126 is from the Oregon Department of Transportation. It requires a motor carrier to report to the Oregon Department of Transportation within 10 days if an employee refuses to take a drug test. It specifies hearings procedures for refusing to take a drug test. It requires administrative law judge to place positive test result or refusal to take the drug test into an employment driving record. Allows a motor carrier to report a positive drug test to the Oregon Department of Transportation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. I've got two people that are currently scheduled to give testimony, Chris Simon, and or Simon maybe, and Greg DePonte.
And, Mr. Chair, for the record, this is a gut and stuff amendment as well.
Oh, one of those favorites.
We get a lot of
old, the gut and stuff amendment.
Right.
It started on 2-5.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
Pretty old.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Greg DePonte. I'm the administrator for the Motor Carrier Transportation Division for the Oregon Department of Transportation. I'm here this morning to talk to you about Senate Bill 126 as amended. This bill seeks to strengthen existing Oregon law that requires reporting to DMV and posting on the employment driving record whenever a truck driver tests positive for drugs or refuses to be tested. The reason we have this bill before you today is there are shortcomings in current law. I'd like to describe those very briefly for you. You have my prepared testimony. I'd like to give you a quick summary. Today, only a medical review officer can report a drug test to the DMV. A medical review officer, or an MRO, is not subject to DMV or ODOT, Motor Carrier Transportation Division regulation, so there's no penalty if they do not file a report. MROs are located across the country, and the concern is that many are ignoring Oregon's law. Even if a motor carrier knows that one of its employee drivers has tested positive for drugs, DMV is not permitted under current law to take a report from the carrier of a positive drug test. No one is currently responsible for reporting when a truck driver refuses to take a drug test. And yet, under federal law, refusal to take a drug test is seen as the equivalent to having taken and obtained a positive test. As a result of the shortcomings, it's possible for a truck driver who tests positive for drugs or refuses to take a test to hide that drug problem and find employment driving trucks. If fired from one job, drivers all too easily can get another job with another unknowing motor carrier. So what this bill, as amended, does means two major changes and three minor changes to correct this situation. The major changes are, first, it allows a motor carrier to report to DMV if the carrier knows that an employee has tested positive for drugs. The second major change is that it requires a motor carrier to report to DMV if an employee refuses to take a drug test. That would apply in every case except for a pre-employment drug test, because at that point in time, the driver is not an employee of the motor carrier. Motor carriers would be subject to penalty for refusing to report such refusals to test. And then there's a series of three minor changes in the bill that amount to, first, changing what can be challenged when a person who is a subject of a drug test-related notice requests a hearing before DMV posts that information on the employment driving record. Such a hearing should not discuss whether the motor carrier has a drug testing program or belongs to a drug test consortium. The hearing should simply confirm that the person named in the report is the person who took the test, and that person is lawfully subject to federal drug testing requirements. Should inquire whether the MRO making the report correctly followed the protocols, and in the case of refusals to test, the circumstances that constitute a refusal to test under federal law. The second minor change is to protect motor carriers so that they may not be held civilly liable for any damage that might result from placing a drug test-related information on the DMV driving record. And finally, the third minor change is simply to amend current law to require that a motor carrier report the name of the service agent, which is called a consortium, used for its drug and alcohol testing program if they do not operate their own program. Under current law, there's an unnecessary specificity that requires the motor carriers to report the names of the people who operate the consortium. We're only interested in knowing that they participate in the consortium and what that consortium is. I'll conclude by saying that in deriving this bill and these amendments, I think the process is just as important as the outcome. And I wanted to just share with you, the safety is very, very important to the Oregon Department of Transportation. It's one of our premier programs within the Motor Carrier Transportation Division. And we're all about trying to reduce truck at fault accidents. And we have learned from our data and our analysis of our data that removing disqualified drivers from the cabs of trucks has a direct correlation to reducing truck at fault accidents. We have brought together in a collaborative work group setting regulatory staff from all over the state that are personally responsible for this part of our regulation. And we asked the folks that are on the ground doing the work, what kind of tools could we provide to them to enable them to deliver a better product in terms of reducing truck at fault accidents. Their number one consensus opinion was that the current loopholes in the law that allow a driver who has tested positive for drugs to leave one employer to simply go down the street and get behind the wheel and get another truck was the single most glaring problem, and they have asked for this legislation. That concludes my formal testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Let me do it this way. Chris, if you'll sign in, let's get all the testimony, then we'll open it up.
Okay. Good morning. Chair Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Chris Simons. I'm Vice President and General Counsel of May Trucking Company, and I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 126. The proposed revisions to the current drug testing regulations for truck drivers will help my company protect not only our drivers, but also all users of our roadways. May Trucking Company is a privately held corporation that operates throughout the continental United States. We're self-insured for automobile liability, both bodily injury and property damage, and we have been since 1986. We were the first company in the country to be granted that status, and we've been continuously self-insured since that time. We're also the largest Oregon-based trucking company. Just to give you an idea of how many people we employ, we have about 775 company drivers, 160 independent contractor drivers, 220 non-driver staff, so a little over 1,100 employees, so pretty good size. Just like Mr. Delpani was saying, we like to work with ODOT. Safety is our paramount concern at May Trucking Company. The motivating factor for us behind having that concern is really twofold. First of all, an avid belief that we owe a duty to the public and to our drivers to be safe, to stay out of accidents. Number two, we obviously have a financial interest in staying out of accidents because we're self-insured. We believe that by fulfilling our duty to protect the safety and welfare of the public, we will be rewarded by having fewer accidents. We have this responsibility to our employees, our customers, and the general public to ensure that our drivers are well-trained and safe. To satisfy that responsibility, we enforce stringent drug and alcohol testing policies that go above and beyond what's mandated by both federal and state law. The primary purpose of our drug testing program is to prevent accidents and injuries resulting from the use of alcohol or controlled substances. All May Trucking Company employees, not just our drivers, are subject to drug and alcohol testing. We instituted these drug testing policies well in advance of actually being required to by federal and state law. Getting more specifically to why I'm here today, May Trucking Company does not hire drivers who have previously tested positive on a drug test. The key is finding out who previously tested positive on a drug test. And under our current system, that information is less than complete. And so by passing Senate Bill 126, it will give us much better information on who actually did test positive. From the first time that we have a driver come into orientation at our company, we make it clear to them, don't use drugs at May Trucking Company, because we will test you at a higher percentage than we are required to. We will catch you, and we will fire you, and we will do everything we can in our power to let the rest of the trucking industry know this person tested positive for drugs. As a company, we've made a commitment to aggressively deal with the use of drugs by truck drivers. The result of this aggressive approach can be seen in our safety record, which is one of the best in the entire industry. Senate Bill 126, as amended, will assist us in keeping drivers who use drugs out of our trucks. Today, May Trucking Company cannot report a positive drug test to the Oregon DMV. Current law only allows a medical review officer to report to the DMV. I believe that May Trucking Company should have the ability to report the positive test results of our drivers to the Department of Motor Vehicles, and Senate Bill 126 allows this. Senate Bill 126 also requires the motor carrier to report to the DMV when a driver refuses to take a drug test. Reporting a refusal to test is just as important as reporting a positive drug test. Current Oregon law does not address drivers who refuse to test and allows drivers to jump from one employer to another in an attempt to outrun their noncompliance with the rules. By requiring motor carriers to report refusals, we can better track truck drivers who hop from job to job and make more informed hiring decisions. Senate Bill 126 improves what is in place today in Oregon. I encourage you to support the bill.
All right, thank you. Questions? I've got one. Looking at the dash ones, and Greg, this is probably going to be for you. On page 3, starting on line 28, this is the section that takes and limits civil liability both to the department and would add in the motor carriers, which I have no problem with. The only thing is it says that they shall be basically exempt from civil liability for any damages resulting in the placing this information onto their driving record. My question is, what if that information was not correct and whatever was posted was not wasn't correct, or if it was done with ill will towards somebody? What would be the recourse, if any, that the person would have for that type of report?
Mr. Chairman, I'll give you my opinion, but I'll qualify by telling you I'm not an attorney.
That's quite all right.
But it seems to me that the way this is constructed, there is a due process. In the event of a positive drug test, the medical review officer is in communication with the driver that tested positive. The driver has an opportunity to explain mitigating circumstances. Maybe he was on seeing a physician, he's receiving prescription drugs that can mask a result. All of that sort of thing is worked out between the person who was tested and the medical review officer. If after that kind of discussion, the medical review officer persists that a positive drug test is appropriate, there's still due process, and the driver who tested positive can request a hearing at DMV and can go through the hearing process as outlined in these amendments. And then after that due process, the result is posted. Now, okay. We can pass a law and say that the motor carrier is exempt from liability, but I imagine that can be contested in court. If in fact someone wanted to make an allegation that there was malice, but I think the due process provisions in the bill preclude that.
All right. So, for the records, what we're basically saying is that there is a due process prior to it being posted, and it's not until after that process runs the course or the person chooses not to engage in that process, meaning that they basically consent to being positive. That's the only time that's the time and only time that the posting would occur is after that process has run its course.
Yes, sir, that is correct.
All right. Other thoughts and questions?
Chair, I don't have a thought or a question. I just could declare conflict of interest because this will impact one of my companies. I do support the bill, though. Great idea.
Senator Paul Meacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to ask, I guess either of you here, about the pre-employment issues, because I noticed that in the original bill you said that a motor carrier may not notify the department of a refusal to take a pre-employment test, but then you changed it to you don't have to, but you could. So what are the circumstances? Because I know Mr. Del Ponte mentioned, well, there may be somebody who's taking prescription medication and that kind of thing. What are the circumstances when that happens, when somebody refuses to take a pre-employment drug test? And it could be for reasons that aren't nefarious, but maybe they are under prescription medication or something. How often do you report that if it's a pre-employment refusal? Or how often would you anticipate reporting that, because you don't report it now, correct?
Chair Przanski, Senator Bonamici, to one of the requirements of driving a truck for a trucking company, regulated trucking company, is that you must take a pre-employment drug test. So to refuse to take a pre-employment drug test, in my experience, I don't think I've seen that happen. I mean, it's one of those situations that's very, it hasn't come up. It's very unusual.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Bonamici, maybe I can explain. I think maybe there's a subtle miscommunication here. We're saying that a motor carrier does not have to report report a refusal to take a pre-employment drug test. Because the simple reality is, at that stage in the game, the individual is not an employee of the motor carrier. The motor carrier has no standing under the bill to report on anyone other than an employee. I think the question you're getting at is the refusal to test. There can be occasions where a refusal to test may not be properly reported to DMV, and here's an example why. One of your good employees, his name comes up in the random test pool. You tell him to report to the testing consortium. He's on his way to the testing consortium, and en route, he gets a phone call that tells him his wife was just involved in a serious car accident. And he doesn't go, to the testing consortium. I'd go to the hospital. So he has an opportunity to explain that circumstance to the department. And based on our view of the circumstances, that may or may not be reported.
Thank you.
All right, so here's where we're at on this. I have some uncomfortness as to my reading of that part and I guess, Chris, I didn't put you on the spot as an attorney, but my reading of this, it basically takes all civil liberty liability off the table, and I think that's too strict. We are going to bring the bill back. It will pass out, but we're going to modify that section to make certain that we don't close off where you have some bad intent on somebody's part of how this might be done. So what we're going to do is we'll carry this one over also for 1 week. That will give us enough time to meet with the department, make certain we get clarification as to the limit or scope of the civil liability. And we'll bring it back in a week, so that's going to be the 21st. And before I close this out, I do have on here, it says Mary Botkin with two question marks after the name, but nothing else. So am I supposed to ask Mary, would you like to testify? Thank you all very much.
She wanted to be asked.
And realize we are going to be pulling this one back. Well, let's see. Andrea's note says to me, I may need to testify.
Sorry.
Oh, now she needs to testify. All right, ladies, let's there are some other obligations that are coming up, so if y'all can keep your comments short since it's coming back in a week, that'd be great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate you calling on me since my question marks were sort of, I wasn't sure whether I needed to or not. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin with AFSCME Council 75, and commercial driver's licenses not only affect drivers who drive for trucking companies, they also affect a number of our members as well. And I just need to make sure that this works within our parameters. I don't see, there's a couple of things that sort of jump out at me. The refusal issue. I don't know how much leeway there is between refusing and not convenient. And he talked about, you know, the wife being in a serious accident. I mean, there may be reasons why people can't get in to be tested that are legitimate. And we just need to be sure, and possibly that whole hearings process will allow for that. There's also no provision for taking the positive testing off the record. If an individual receives appropriate treatment and has not had a reoccurrence of drug usage, then the elimination of their livelihood forever seems a little excessive. You know, I would just like to see some ability for the person to get to clean up their record at some point. And then the errors you brought up as well, Mr. Chair, and that was another thing that occurred to me was, what if there's a mistake? My son has a commercial driver's license with a hazmat endorsement. He has driven for Oak Harbor Freight for over 9 years. He has never had a dirty test. And I'm proud of that. You know, he will tell you that one of the biggest problems they have on the road are people who are unsafe drivers, whether it's drug and alcohol related or whether it's just inability to do it. But regardless, I mean, I think there's a lot of reasons why we should, like, be sure that these people are driving well. And then finally, the administrative law judge issue. Unless I am mistaken, when you appear before an administrative law judge, you are required to have an attorney representing you now.
No.
Okay.
Not true. Yeah, that's not a full employment act for attorneys. That doesn't quite work that way. But it is an option. It is an option, but it's not.
Yeah, you may need to have an attorney.
Here I know.
With you.
I'm in three of them.
Since everybody in the room is an attorney but you, you probably ought to have one. But anyway, those are my only concerns.
All right. Andrew, do you have a few things you'll cover?
Yes, just briefly, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. I'm hoping there was simply a drafting change and mistake from the original bill to the Dash 1 amendments related to the pre-employment. As you know, the private sector can insist on doing a drug test for someone, and it's not a Fourth Amendment search because it's the private sector. The government may not do so, and the government therefore also may not penalize you for refusing to do a pre-employment drug testing. And that's what I think the original bill intended to capture by saying on page 2, lines 32 to 33, a motor carrier may not notify the department of a person's refusal to take a pre-employment drug test. I read that with the new language LC uses as a complete bar on notification to ODOT that someone refused to do that. The Dash 1 amendments, page 2, lines 6 through 7, say a motor carrier is not required to notify the department of a person's refusal to take a pre-employment test. And then, of course, it later on states that the driving record shall include all reports of a drug test result and refusals to submit to drug tests that are made by the department under this section. So the problem I read in that is a motor carrier is not required, does not prohibit a motor carrier from actually notifying ODOT of a refusal to take a pre-employment test. And I would like to see the language go back to the original bill with may not notify. I think it would be consistent and get you remove any constitutional concerns we might have about moving forward with the language.
All right. Questions? Comments? Thank you very much. Was there anyone else who wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 126? Not seeing anyone coming forward, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 126. And we're going to go ahead and open up our last public hearing that we have scheduled for today, Senate Bill 955.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 955 limits causes of action based on negligence against design professionals to the person to whom the design professional contracted, and it applies retroactively. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All right. We have a number of people who want to give testimony today, and I'm going to see if we have a panel here. Marshall, why don't you come up, and Aaron and Cindy Roberts.
Good morning, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee. My name is Marshall Koba, representing the American Council of Engineering Companies of Oregon. ACEC represents more than 110 member firms and approximately 3,000 private sector consulting engineers. We're here today in support of Senate Bill 955. Senate Bill 955 is drafted to add clarity to the economic loss doctrine concept that was confused, we believe, somewhat by a recent Supreme Court case. To add more clarity to Senate Bill 955 is Aaron Austin, an attorney with David Evans & Associates, one of Oregon's premier engineering firms. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Aaron Austin. I'm an in-house attorney for David Evans & Associates. I've been with the firm over 11 years. My primary responsibilities include reviewing, drafting, and negotiating contracts. I'm also responsible for helping to procure the insurance and manage claims and litigation. So I see the consequences resulting from the contracts that are agreed to by the company. Part of the contract terms that we look at include reviewing the scope of service, the types of allocation of risks that might include a standard of care or a limitation of liability or some other allocation, depending on the party who has the best position to mitigate those risks, maybe through insurance or other activities. So these choices in the contract do affect the cost of the work. And if we can't identify, manage those risks, then the cost of the work does increase. This bill is about the economic loss rule and the need for clarification so that the exposure to design professionals is more predictable. In a traditional economic loss rule, claims for purely economic losses are not allowed except under contract law. Claims involving personal injury and property damage, of course, are still allowed. For, as an example, using a lawnmower, if you purchase a lawnmower and you have a problem, a piece of the mower flies off, injures someone in the eye, and that person loses time at work, the loss of income because of the injury, of course, is allowed as a type of economic loss, and that is not what we're talking about in this bill. If someone is dissatisfied with the performance of the mower, or is dissatisfied because the lawnmower doesn't last as long as they anticipate, and wants to recoup the damages related to the cost of that mower, that is an economic loss that we are talking about, because the claim should be addressed through the agreement that they had in purchasing that mower, which, of course, contemplates the cost and quality in purchasing the item. If I can also use an example from my own experience, this is an example from another state in which we were hired to design a roadway. The road, the client, which was a developer, had requested that we use a lower quality item, and it was a roadway that had a valley gutter in the middle of the road, and wanted to use entirely asphalt. Typically, you would use a ribbon of concrete to help protect the integrity of the design as water, flows over it. Unfortunately, after the project turned over to the homeowners, the road did fail early because of a significant cracking, and the homeowners association, which was still a number of years after the work was completed, sued us. Now, this was another state under different circumstances, so the resolution was somewhat different, but the illustration is that we had a contract based on certain scope items, certain agreement for price, and decisions made by another party to go with the asphalt as opposed to a higher level concrete. And that was something that was addressed in the contract. Allocation of the risk was identified, but those considerations of the contract are thrown out, then we are left with an exposure that we can't always anticipate or predict, and therefore it affects our ability to adequately price or obtain insurance. So the design professional's exposure can be unpredictable without the contract. Under the recent case Harris v. Suniga, the definition of property damage and the interface of a contract terms are uncertain. It is uncertain because the parties cannot rely on the contracts they've signed. The practical effect is that the design professional can be sued by a subsequent owner of the property on which services were performed for someone else, even though the design professional did not contract with that particular party. Negotiated contract limitations, scopes of services, design criteria, or reduced standards of design may not be applicable under such a negligence claim. The plaintiff need only establish that the standard of care of other reasonable professionals providing such services would have been different. Regardless of the contract terms, a third party now has the right to sue the design professional, even though the design professional agreed to a reduced scope of service to save the client money. If a more comprehensive design would have prevented the damage, there is now a potential for a claim. Even though the design professional was not paid to provide additional services that could have identified the problem, there is now a potential for a claim. Even though the design professional weighed the risks of the design and agreed to complete the project because those risks could be mitigated by the contract terms, there is a potential for a claim because those contract terms do not apply to third parties, and therefore limiting risks and exposure via the contract is not reliable. With Senate Bill 955, we hope to achieve a clarity and predictability for the economic loss rule as it applies to design professionals. We also hope that certainty in our contract terms will be enforced. Design professionals will remain liable for bodily injury, property damage, when sued outside the contract. Thank you.
Thank you. Cindy?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I'm proud to represent the American Institute of Architects in Oregon. First of all, let me apologize. I would like to say that the redness in my eyes and my face is because I stayed up all night studying this really exciting topic, but it's not. I'm having an allergic reaction, so excuse me if I cough or my eyes weep. You know, I didn't really understand this issue when I first delved into it. I'm not a lawyer, and I won't pretend to understand some of the words you've used, like privity and there's a privity. I don't understand those, but I will tell you this. As I looked into this issue, it became pretty clear to me that this is a distinction between tort law and contract law. Tort law is when an architect can be sued for injury, property damage, death, and in contract law, the architect can be sued for, among other things, breach of contract, failure of contract provisions, non-performance, and economic loss. The economic loss doctrine says that a person cannot recover from another person in torts for purely economic damages. For economic damages, you must look to the contract law. So in contract law, we have the agreed-upon expectations, parameters, and remedies. These have been negotiated by the two parties to the contract, and the economic loss doctrine prevents parties to that contract from avoiding these remedies and seeking broader remedies under tort law than the contract would have permitted. So, although it's oversimplistic, as I understand it, the economic loss doctrine represents the line between the law of contracts, which secures the expectations of the parties in an agreement, and the law of torts, which is governed by the duty owed to an injured party without regard to any contract. Good.
You're working your degree yet.
Yeah. The most important word here, for at least my purposes and my understanding, the most important word within this whole definition is the word contract. And for Senate Bill 955, contract is the issue that at least the architects, and we're appreciated by the engineers bringing this up, but the contract is the actual word that we're most concerned with. Sometimes the owner of a structure does not have a contract with the architect, and sometimes they just have one with the general contractor. Sometimes the owner has a contract with the architect, and the general contractor does not. It's about 90% of the time that we have, architects have a contract with the owner, about 10% of the time that we have a contract with the general contractor, and those are mostly design-build situations. When there's no contract between the owner and the architect, or between the general contractor and the architect, how can contract law be applied? The contract creates the relationship by which the architect is responsible for the economic interest of the client. Without a contract, there is no such relationship. And without a contract, we don't believe that you can bring the civil action described in Senate Bill 955.
All right, thank you. Questions? I've got one I'm going to throw out on the table here. Third-party beneficiaries. Oregon law does allow for that to occur. I have, a situation where a constituent had a general contractor build a house. Of course, the general subbed out a lot of the work. And CCB says that the owner couldn't go against the sub because the contract was with the general. But when we did the research, Oregon law does allow for a suit for third-party beneficiary because the subcontractor was brought in knowing that what he was doing or this company was doing was for the benefit of the owner or the person that had the contract with the general contractor. So is this the scenario that the court has kind of came down on that other decision that you mentioned?
Well, no, that was not part of the evaluation. In fact, in the Harris v. Seniga case, it exclusively looked at the tort remedies and did not address any of the contracting issues. A third-party beneficiary issue is a contract issue, and if, like in our contracts, we try and identify those parties, or we say in our contracts there are no third-party beneficiaries. But if that discussion between the client and the architect or engineer doesn't occur, how can we identify those particular interests and take action or you know, take some kind of responsibility within the design to address those issues. And the concern, again, is that you have some unknown party having a remedy that's far exceeds the remedy anticipated when you originally agree under the contract for a price and an obligation. So you can have someone get something much greater than what you anticipated in taking a job.
Okay, fair enough. Just want to get some stuff on the record. Any other questions? All right, thank you all very much for coming forward.
Thank
our
you.
Next panel is going to be, is it Rich Vile? Kevin Parker, if I got that right, and Jana Owaska. I said that wrong.
Chair Iwasaki, that's Jana Iwasaki.
Iwasaki, excuse me, Bert.
And Brad Smith, another homeowner with one of our homeowner associations, also came in a bit later. I'd like to introduce Brad during this panel, if we might. Do you mind if
we can bring the chair up?
Thank you.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Richard Vile. I'm an attorney with Vile Fotheringham. By way of odd affiliations, we are also members of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association, and I'm here today on behalf of our approximately 2,000 homeowner association clients and also representing OTLA. The bill that you have before you does constitute a reaction to Harris versus Suniga. And as Ms. Austin testified, it is an attempt to limit claims to contract claims. It is important that you understand that this is not something that would stop with design professionals should you choose to carry the bill forward and adopt it. General contractors would be back here making exactly the same argument. For example, in a homeowners association, which is our primary focus, a developer hires a general contractor to build a condominium, then turns that condominium over later to a homeowners association. There is obviously no contract between the homeowners association and the general contractor. The general contractor would be here saying, please limit our exposure to our contract claims as we negotiated with the developer. The homeowners association would therefore have absolutely no recourse back to the contractor should it turn out that there were significant construction defects. The economic loss doctrine is one that's about 20 years old, and it has been debated in many jurisdictions around the country. It does not work in the construction environment, and we are seeing a serious erosion of that, not just in Oregon, but in many jurisdictions with decisions like the Harris versus Suniga decision that our Supreme Court handed down just recently. We have brought today Kevin Harker of our firm, who recently assisted a large homeowners association that had a very serious design problem. Kevin's going to describe that briefly, and then I'd like the two private citizens, Ms. Iwasaki and Mr. Smith, to describe the situations that they encountered as members of the board of directors of their homeowners association.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, my name is Kevin Harker. I am with the firm of Vile Fotheringham as well. About a year ago, we litigated a case in Washington County, and the issue in that case was the design professional and the geotechnical engineers completely missed a landslide area. And as a result, when the retaining wall was built on the south side of the property, measures were not taken to prevent the wall from moving. In 2006, the wall did move, and what happened was six of the units that were adjacent to the wall slid with that wall when it shifted. The county red-tagged those units, and the owners were evicted. Had SB 955 been in effect at the time, my client, Jana Iwasaki, there's a potential that that recovery from those design professionals would not have been there, and those owners of the association would have been stuck with the bill to fix that wall. Mr. Vile will discuss some of the points that I've made in my letter that I've submitted today, and at this time I'll turn the microphone over to Mrs. Iwasaki.
Chair Przanski and members of the committee, my name is Jana Iwasaki. I live in Washington County. I'm secretary of our Homeowners Association. This is the Brownstone Orenco Park Homeowners Association. We settled about 2 years ago, and $1.5 million of that settlement was money in particular because of this design issues with the which caused a landslide, and it's been quite a hardship in our neighborhood. As Mr. Harker said, there are six units that have been unlivable going on over 2 years now, and so these people have relocated and are still paying their mortgages actually and property taxes. I just can't imagine the additional hardship that would have been placed on the rest of the community had we not recovered that portion of the settlement. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Smith, I believe.
Good morning, Senator Przanski, members of the committee. My name is Brad Smith, and I'm here actually in two roles. First, I'm the managing partner of Bixby Northwest. We own and operate industrial and commercial real estate in Oregon, California, Nevada, and Arizona. To put some specifics on this situation, I purchased the commercial space at 1111 Northeast Broadway, the Irvington Place condominiums, at the end of 2005. At the time we purchased the property, it was known that there were certain construction defect issues that were under consideration, and there was an indemnification clause that was put in the contract. I should also mention that I'm also here in the role of a board member of the HOA for Irvington Place. The underlying problem that we encountered was that the design on the building was fundamentally flawed, and there were some very significant water intrusion issues that took quite a period of time to show up and be seen. We had improperly designed flashing, improper installation of the flashings, and water infiltration coming in behind the stucco. Not surprisingly, there were a series of lawsuits, and in the course of the process, the design professionals, the general contractor, and the subcontractors all pointed fingers at each other, confirming that it was the other guy's fault that the system failed, and that in no case were they responsible. However, when the dust had settled and we finally had a settlement on this project, which I might add was the largest construction defect settlement in Portland. It was quite a substantial defect. The design professionals were held to be a significant component of this and they were a significant contributor to the final settlement, which has allowed the Homeowners Association now to actually go through the reconstruction process, which we're in at the moment. The reason that I think the Senate bill that's being considered is a real problem is that in this situation, a lot of the basic problems that permitted the water intrusion were due to inadequate design, inappropriately designed flashings, inappropriate supervision of the project. And so I think it would be a very unfortunate situation for situations like this for the design professionals to not be held responsible for what turned out to be some very significant intrinsic design flaws in their in the design that they originally presented. I guess that would be about it. Any questions or comments?
I have a final comment, and then we'd be happy to take questions.
All right.
Thank you, Chair Przanski. One of the most egregious examples of how Senate Bill 955 would leave homeowner associations in particular without a remedy is found in ORS 655 sub 4. This is the provision that requires developers who are converting apartment complexes to the condominium form of ownership to estimate the remaining useful life of the various components. Important because in order to set how much the dues are going to be or assessments are going to be, they've got to be able to project when something will need replacement or significant maintenance. That's only fair so that both the owner and the lender, or the purchaser and the lender, can understand what their financial obligations might be. The statute allows the developer to escape liability for missing that component, for in other words, underestimating the amount of the repairs necessary or overestimating the remaining useful life by, quote, not having actual knowledge of any inaccuracies in a statement and, quote, relying upon reports prepared by licensed engineers or architects in making the statement. Often, developers currently go to a licensed engineer or architect and say, estimate the remaining useful life for me, please. They do so, and in our experience, about half the time, the architects or engineers are completely missing the time frames. They'll estimate remaining useful life at 30 years because they haven't taken a careful look and don't realize that they've already got a dry rot problem happening on a deck or behind a wall. As a result, if Senate Bill 955 were to pass and the architect and engineer had their contract with the developer, and the developer now says, I'm not responsible under the statute because I relied upon an architect or engineer, the homeowners association is left without any remedy whatsoever in that circumstance. That is but one example. We believe that there are many examples, and I could quote them to you at length. But with that, we'd be happy to take questions. Thank you.
If you want to submit that in writing, feel free to do so. But I'm glad that you're not going to quote and link today. So questions, comments? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I want to ask Mr. Vial or Mr. Harker, with regard to the Washington County situation that you mentioned with Ms. Awasaki's homeowners association, what did you claim under existing law, and if this bill passed, what would you be left with in terms of claiming how to get a remedy for that situation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici, our primary claim was a negligence claim. In other words, you screwed up, you caused damage to us and to my clients. So it was a negligence claim.
Against
both the general contractor and against the design professionals. We asserted claims against both. Had SB 955 been in effect, that we have no contract with the design professionals. There was no contract between the homeowners association or any of the individual owners. In that particular case, had 9.5 been in effect, we could have been left without a negligence cause of action because there is no other cause of action, no contract.
Chair Prozanski, Senator Bonamici, to clarify just a little bit more, one of the things that Ms. Austin was talking about is this need for everyone to try and negotiate the limits of their liability. And the insurance contracts that for the most part are out there say, we're not going to cover your work. In other words, we're not going to cover you for doing something negligently. We're only going to cover your work if it causes damage to someone else. In this case, the shifting of the wall and the shifting of these units caused maybe $15,000 of damage to the inside of the units, sheetrock, buckling, etc. But it cost about $1.5 million to re-excavate and fix the wall. Had 955 been in place, we maybe could have recovered for the interior sheetrock, the $15,000 a unit, so maybe $120,000, we would have been left without any remedy at all for the $1.5 million of their work, the one that they specifically were responsible for designing. So it would have been a horrible, as Ms. Iwasaki testified, burden to then allocate that $1.5 million among the owners individually as a special assessment.
Thank you.
Any other questions, comments? Thank you all very much for coming forward. The last two that I have scheduled is John Chandler and Dean Aldridge. And committee, I have another engagement I'm going to step out for, so.
Senator Boquist. Go ahead, John.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builder Association, here mumbling about Senate Bill 955. I believe that the case Harris v. Zuniga was wrongly decided. I remember reading it when it came out. I wouldn't want to take a quiz on it now, frankly. I think it overreached in terms of the extension of the economic loss rule. It did cause us, from the home builder's perspective, who are general contractors oftentimes, to look to our insurance policies, our warranty policies, make sure that everything was covered, given the expansion of recovery that was made potential under Harris v. Zuniga. Having said that, the narrowness of the bill in front of you caused me some concern. One of the previous speakers, Mr. Vile, said he didn't think it would be long before the contractors came in and asked for relief, and I'm glad to prove him accurate. We think this case needs to be discussed, and we think it needs to be discussed in the broader context of what's fair for plaintiffs and what's fair for contractors and what's within the scope of the contract between the generals and the subs and the reasonable expectations of those parties vis-a-vis downstream purchasers of real property. The issues underlying the Harris case are legitimate and real, as you've heard. The outcome it reached, I think, was probably a tad extreme. I'm not sure this bill gets us where we need to go, and it certainly doesn't get the general contractors where we think we need to go in terms of our reasonable expectations of protection against lawsuits from people we have no relationship with and no way of knowing they existed. There may be other ways to approach the topic through warranty, through insurance. This conversation ought to occur on a more broad basis. That's the main comment I wanted to make, Mr. Vice Chair, and I did also want to call the committee's attention to the doctrine of sea prey and how it might pertain to this issue.
Thank you, John Dean.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dean Aldrich. I'm here on behalf of OTLA as well as current clients. I'm here in opposition to Senate Bill 955. I've got a bit of a different background. I'd like to go into it because it can provide some context for my comments. I've got a degree in civil engineering from Oregon State University, and I was in the construction business for 3 years as a project manager up in Portland. Since law school, I've been involved mainly in complex construction-related litigation, and I primarily represent property both residential and commercial. I also represent contractors, design professionals, and suppliers in construction defect actions. The main bulk of my practice for the past 10 years has been in construction defect actions, trying to get them resolved. I previously testified in front of the legislature about these issues, and I've testified in front of the Construction Claims Task Force. I think Senate Bill 955 is a bad idea for 5 reasons, and these reasons I've summarized in a handout that I've provided. The first one that was touched upon briefly with a couple examples is design professional negligence causes property damage and significant loss to improvements. There are some examples. There's a Street of Dreams house from 2006 that slid down the hill 2 months after the family first purchased it. They had to evacuate. The home became a total loss. They had to file an action directly because of issues with the builder and coverage. The family filed lawsuit against the geotechnical engineers involved. That was an important part of their recovery. They sued them in negligence. Negligence cause of action, basically you're suing somebody for violating the minimal standard of care and if they cause property damage. Marshall Wells Condos, a conversion condo, which Mr. Vile spoke about, where the condominium purchasers relied on a condition assessment that was provided by a design professional, and they sued that professional directly. Lakewood's loss, there was a negligent slab design, caused incredible construction defects because the building, in essence, the top floors, which were the condos, were sinking down into the garage because of the bad slab design. Viewpoint townhomes, negligent foundation, retaining wall design, that was an evacuation and total loss. And it goes on a few other condominiums, and I think the important thing to point out in these particular circumstances is these are end-use consumers who have no role in the construction process, and the negligence cause of action is very important to their ability to get full recovery. The chair asked earlier about third-party beneficiary. We've tried to use that. That law is entirely unclear.
about how that applies in these circumstances, that's a mixed bag. The negligence cause of action is the appropriate cause of action, both against contractors and against design professionals who are involved in this. My second point is that the design professionals owe a duty to the public. The engineers were up here talking earlier about how they try to limit their liability by contract. However, under Oregon law, the licensing statutes allow that the primary obligation for design professionals is the protection of public health, safety, and welfare, including property. And further, by administrative rule, architects have a duty to perform construction supervision on many projects that they stamp. Those can't be abrogated.
Have your written testimony, so okay. Try and summarize these areas, all right?
I will. Thank you very much, Mr. Vice Chair. Harris v. Seniga, that confirmed 30-year-old Oregon law. You read the opinion, it relies on Newman versus Twelton Development Corporation, which was some condominium purchasers who sued a contractor. That's a 30-year-old case. Senate bill improperly shifts the risks to the design professionals. The negligence to consumers and impacts the consumer's ability to recover loss. Senate Bill 955 would have direct implications even on design professional liability where a consumer was not able to sue the design professional, and if the developer did, which is what the bill intends to do, it eliminates third-party construction contribution and indemnity claims, although it expressly provides that it allows them. In a sense, it does not. Senate Bill 955 does not solve the problem. Basically, you solve these problems by building and designing the project right in the first place. That's it.
Thank you, Dean. Committee members, questions? Senator Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm really tempted to ask Mr. Chandler about Sea Prey, but I don't think I will. Mr. Aldrich, I wanted to ask you about sort of general negligence principles that to recover under negligence, you still have to prove a duty, correct?
Yes, you do have to prove a duty. And in essence, what we're finding in some of these where a design professional, in essence, says that part of my duty was defined by contract, and so the design professional can use that as a defense if they tried to allocate risk. But the negligence cause of action, the duty is the minimal duty. That's a duty that you can't circumscribe by contract. And that's, in essence, for a design professional, that's the minimum standard of care used by design professionals practicing in the locale that you are.
Okay, and it's been a while since I studied this, but there also has to be some sort of foreseeability. Is
yes.
that correct? Okay, and so that's part of the case as well.
That's part of the case, and in my closing comment on my outline is all these defenses are currently available. I mean, you solve the problem by building the projects and designing them right in the first place. You don't limit people's liability after the fact, and in fact, this law has retroactive applicability, so I've got current cases going on right now where I represent a condominium association or an owner against a design professional for property damage where there's no contract. This law would eliminate that claim. And just, if there's some confusion about what property damage was, I'll make this point. A key element of a negligence claim is property damage. What this law attempts to do is define that property damage as if you have a condominium and it collapses and it injures your arm, you get a broken arm, and it injures your toaster. You can sue in negligence under this law for your broken arm and for your toaster, but you cannot sue to get your building that was collapsed repaired.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, John. All right. Is there anybody else that wants to testify on SB 955? I don't know what the chair's intent is, so he'll get back with you on that. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 955. Council, I don't think there's anything else on the agenda, is there?
I think that's it for our agenda.
And start time tomorrow is?
8 a.m.
0800 tomorrow morning. Great
Thanks
fun.
Thanks for with the that, reminder, Mr. Minister.
With that, we'll close the committee meeting for the day.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. I can't.